The question is the author of material that has potentially devastating consequences responsible for the consequences of how people use that material, or are the people themselves responsible? The example being, in a recent case, a couple of college students accidentally killed themselves, one or both, by making a homemade bomb, and they had read how to do that in a book that is publicly available, or how to make the bomb. The question is the author of that material somehow responsible, or is it up to each reader to take responsibility for their own actions regarding whatever knowledge they might find?
There are two issues that we're dealing with, okay? One issue is educating our young of how to live life correctly, what to do in life, okay? That's one issue. Second issue is that, in other words, should we have a censorship of the material that people that do have the wrong idea of life and what is right to do in life, right? Let's face it, these kids did the wrong thing. So the question is, do we have an obligation to protect them by not writing this information, okay? That we discussed this idea, not this particular case, but this idea in Proverbs. In chapter 10, verse 6, we said, a blessing to the head of the righteous. And we said, what is that blessing? We said, it is a secret. That the righteous have a right and an obligation and a responsibility to know what information to give out and what information they should not give out. Okay? So the thing is, on the side of the author, in our society, we have to know which information can be harmful to the public, okay, so that we shouldn't give it to them. Absolutely not. That's one side. The other side is that many times when we attack the people that wrote this information, the reason, the motive for the attack, even though I'm agreeing that they might be right, that maybe there should be a certain censorship, but many times the motive itself is to cover our own lack that we did not educate our children correctly. And we don't stop to think, maybe I should learn to educate my children better. Maybe there should be morals and ethics taught to our children, not just math and science. Maybe it should be a subject, you see. So the thing is that both sides are correct, that when the author tells the parents of the people that died, of the children that died, that, well, it's your responsibility to train your children correctly, he's right. But they are also right in telling him, but we're humans and we're not on the highest level of righteousness, and therefore you also have to be careful of what you say and help us protect our children in their ignorance until we do educate them. It takes a certain amount of time. So I'm saying both arguments are correct, and both arguments should be looked into, investigated. In other words, how far censorship should be, how far is really protection, and two, can we change the education of our children that they shouldn't do these type of things? In the book of Tanakh, there is one book called 12 Prophets. Really, in the Hebrew, it's Treyos, it's just called 12. But many people translate it as the 12 minor prophets, but they were not minor, that I can guarantee. But the question is why are these put together as a unit known as the 12? The question is, why is it put together? Sometimes we look for big philosophical and abstract reasons when really that's really a very simple reason. Since what they had to write was very short, what was necessary for the public to know, the future generations, were very short. So if it's only a couple of pages, these pages are easy to get lost. So to make sure that these prophets were not lost, they bound them together in one book and called it the 12 so that they should be always bound together, so they shouldn't be lost. This I remember from one of the commentaries at the beginning of the book of 12. We have many, many emotions, and when we usually discuss emotions, we try to understand the emotion psychologically. But however, emotions also, when it's acted out, it's also a philosophy of life. It becomes a philosophy of life. For instance, greed and stingy, okay? Greed, the difference between greed and stingy, greed is in the making of money, the acquisition of money, and stingy is in the spending of money, okay? So greed says that, you could spend money, but you kind of constantly make it. You can never stop making it. Money is something you should always make, something like that, okay? Like, for instance, there was a man that was worth around $30 million, and they asked him, how does it feel to be a rich man? He says, I'm not a rich man. That guy that has $90 million, he's a rich man. So the thing is that the philosophy of greed is to never, ever stop making money. Philosophy of stingy is, go out and make money, but never spend it. Okay? You got to pile it up, like Scrooge McDuck, who goes swimming in his gold, right? So the thing is that that's the philosophy there. Now the question is, since this is the philosophy, if it is an incorrect philosophy, as a philosophy, we have to analyze it, right? And we also have to find the correct philosophy for money, okay? So what is the correct philosophy for money? Basically, something like this, that money is simply a practical thing, that it's a way of attaining things. So you need money to buy your needs and luxuries. And also there's a certain amount that you need for security, for time of tragedy. If something terrible happens, how much money do you need? How much insurance do you need? And then you need for retirement. That's a practical thing. So it should be worked out practical. Once you reach the practical point, then you should quit. You see? Now the thing is what I'm saying, if you go through all the emotions, you see, instead of you can analyze it from a psychological point of view. What I'm saying, you could also analyze it from a philosophical point of view. Like most of the times when people talk about vengeance, when they really mean vengeance, they say they demand justice. See, vengeance is a type of justice. It's a system of justice. Now the question is it a correct system of justice? So now the system of justice has to be analyzed, and you have to analyze what is justice. And let's say your vengeance plays a role, if there's any rationale behind vengeance when it comes to justice, you see? So the thing is, if you go through all the emotions, you can have different, you start seeing the different philosophies in the world around you, the incorrect view from the philosophical point of view, and then the question is, what is the correct one? Is there a difference between greed and stingy as an emotion? What's the difference between that and when you listen to music and it stirs your emotions, the listening to the music? You see? Good question, huh? The question is how you relate to music. Music is sometimes you just listen to and it just, like for instance, if you're depressed, so you listen to lively music, it pulls you out of your depression. Okay? So the thing is that their music, you're not making any decisions. In other words, it's affecting your emotions, but it's not affecting you in so far as you make decisions. We always say that what's wrong with emotions is that if it causes you to make decisions, that's dangerous. You see? But if it's simply it affects you and you feel good, there's a good feeling, that we're not against. We're not against feeling good. Okay? We're only, like, for instance, let's say sometimes there's wild music that gets people hepped up and they start shoving and hurting each other. You understand? That type of music, then we would question that they would say that's a harm because they're making decisions. The music is getting them to move, to make decisions, to do things. So in that case, we would say that it's incorrect. Are there good emotions? And like, for instance, let's say you have a feeling to be kind. Like there's certain people that have this feeling of being kind. Now, we'll take the extreme case. See, let's say, for instance, a person wants to be kind to a person like Hitler, to help Hitler. Hitler feels bad. Should you help him? Now, definitely, the emotion to feel kind might want to do that, but however, rationale will tell you not to help them. So therefore, you got to be very careful that what we're saying is that any emotion taken to an extreme can be harmful, and therefore the only thing that could evaluate when yes and when not, what should be your decision maker, is your mind, where it's really thought out. Is how far should you go with making decisions based on the mind? There is a case where Abraham, there was a famine in the land, and the only place that he could go to get away from the famine was to an evil kingdom where they could kill him. So according to one of the commentaries, he had a choice between starvation and going to a kingdom where they'd probably kill him. What the commentary points out is that he made a decision. The fact that he left one place and went to the other shows that a decision was made. And he says, therefore, in every area of life, you should always evaluate wherever you have two possibilities. It should always be evaluated by the mind to decide. You must have methods to be reasons to decide one way or the other. Okay? Even if you want to go have pleasure, the mind should decide if that is a pleasure you should partake of.
If a person made a fixed amount per hour, say, and could exactly meet his needs and, say, family's needs working, say, 6 hours a day, so then anything you worked over that would allow you to save for retirement, and the more you worked over, the faster you could save up enough to meet all your life's needs, so then you could stop working and study all the time. What's the balance point between working to save for when you won't have to work and your future needs versus taking time to study now?
One man in the seminary, there were two philosophies. One philosophy was that you should go out and work for around 4 or 5 years, make a lot of money, and then go back and sit back down and study Torah. Okay? The other philosophy was, no, continue studying Torah now, and as you have to go out for practical reasons, then you should go out into the world to work. Okay? That was the two philosophies. Now, those people that went out to make money in 5 years, they never made it back. Okay? Because what happens is that when you are doing something, you'll become emotionally attached to it. And if you give up your time in learning and you put that time into work, I'm not saying a person can't save for the future. It is possible that a person could make money and still be involved in learning, and he can make a lot of money and retire. It is possible. But you have to be very, very careful with such a plan if you make a decision like that, that you don't get pulled out of learning. There was a guy that wanted to become a doctor, and he had to go to medical school and interning. I mean, you're talking about hours upon hours. So what he did was he found 4 or 5 other Jewish people that were going and that knew about learning, and he prepared a class for them to force himself to stay in learning under all that pressure. He knew that if he didn't learn at all for years, he would never come out. He knew he had to keep in learning. So the only way he could do it was if he knew if he had to prepare a class. I mean, you have to prepare. So he prepared a class and gave a class while he was going to med school. And the guy is in learning now. He's a doctor, he's a surgeon, and he's still involved in learning because he never pulled out. You see? Well, see, sometimes a person has a need to live a certain lifestyle or have a certain amount of security. Certain people need a lot of security. So if they need that security, then you have to give it to them, or not, they're going to fail. You see, there was a difference of opinion among the sages. There was a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yishmael, and he says a person should learn a trade and then learn. Well, you know, he could learn a trade while he's learning. And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said that a person should learn and work basically day by day. You know, whatever you need for the day, work for the day, and then sit and learn the rest of the day. So our sages tell us that practically what happened, that there were a lot that tried it like Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, and they failed. And a lot tried it like Rabbi Yishmael, and they were successful. What's the difference? The answer is that there's not a difference of opinion between Reb Shimon ben Yochai and Reb Yishmael. But the thing is, it depends how much security you need. Reb Shimon ben Yochai doesn't need security. He was, you know what I mean? So if he didn't have the money, he would still be able to learn. But another person, if they don't have that money coming in, they'd be so tense they can't learn because they need the security. So one person we have to say, look, according to your emotions, you won't learn at all. If you try and act like you're on the highest level, you can't learn at all. That's foolish. So then what you have to do is you have to satisfy that security. But for another person will say, I really don't feel insecure if I don't have the money. I'm sure I can work it out. I have no problem. Well, that person should spend his time learning and just make the money as he needs it. Get back to the original subject of where we started, that that every emotion has a philosophy. Okay? Now, the thing is, the practical way of operating, of dealing with this, is you should always start from the philosophy. See, a lot of people hold, like for instance, they study Torah, and the Torah holds certain emotions are wrong, so they try to undo it. And that is not the approach. You have to understand why and how it works before you deal with emotions. Okay? Now, many times, just knowing the truth, you could do the truth without dealing with the emotions, so you don't have to deal with the emotions. Therefore, I say deal first on the philosophical level. Like, let's say, for instance, you're greedy. So the first thing you should do is sit down and study the idea of money and what's the value of money, and review that idea philosophically. What's the correct way of acting in this world, and see why it makes sense. Do you get the information from the secular world? You see, the Torah gives you the general principles how to live, but the practical, the details, are infinite. The Torah is not going to write how to work out precisely your money problems. And for besides which, in every society, there's sometimes different. Some societies barter, some societies are money, and then there's different, you know what I mean? So how you work out the details depends on your situation. What they do is give you the general principles, and then how you work it out depends on you, depends on your society, depends on a lot of factors. So, but the first thing is that you have to work out what is right, the correct way to live, and many times, just seeing the truth become, when it's very clear to the mind, you see it clearly in every step, so then that's enough to make you, cause you to do it, or maybe by reviewing it a certain amount of time, it'll affect your emotions. So then, just by knowing the truth, that could make you do the correct act. Okay? But however, if you cannot, by studying the philosophy, the practical way of doing, does not work. In other words, your emotions are strong, and even by studying the truth, the emotions don't let you carry out that philosophy, then you must analyze that emotion and how that emotion works and the nature of that emotion, and then by studying that emotion and recognizing the fallacy in it from the emotional point of view, not from the philosophical. In other words, the philosophical view that it's wrong should be known in the first step, because you're analyzing, let's say with money, what's the correct way of dealing with money, you'll also know why it's incorrect to be greedy. You understand? Or if you study justice, so then you'll see why vengeance is unjust. And you'll be able to put it in clear terms, not just say vengeance is wrong, but you'll be able to prove that it's wrong. But if all this analysis doesn't work, then you must analyze the emotion not from the philosophical point, but from the emotional point. And if you're thorough in that, and you've studied it and reviewed it and gone over it, and it still doesn't affect you, then the only thing left is to do a thorough analysis of your whole personality. Okay? So that would be the third level. So that's really in other words, what we're saying is a general view of life is that what you do is you start by knowing the reality, what's the right thing to do, and why philosophically the wrong thing is incorrect, you see? Then if that helps you change your life, that's fine. If it doesn't, then you have to study the emotion in general, the nature of the emotion, and try to see how it works. and then sometimes that could help you live the correct life. If you can't, if it's still affecting you, so then you have to undo, then you have to see the total personality. Okay? The question is, if I could give an illustration, and I decided to give an illustration in Judaism, we have fast days. Now, four of our fast days deals with the destruction of the temple. Okay? So the question is what is the benefit of a fast? What is the benefit? Like many times my students say, on a fast day, it's hard to concentrate, so what good is the fast day? I'm better off eating. I could repent easier if I eat. You know what I mean? If I'm fasting. It's a good question. So what's the benefit? All right. So I said the first thing you have to understand, if you're lacking in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, then you have to understand, does anybody know what the loss is?
What the loss is?
What the loss is. Lost. In other words, you lost something. You lost the temple. Now, if you, let's say your car was broken, right? You know what you lost, right? If your house burns down, you cry because you know what you lost, okay? But how many people know the loss of the temple? What'd you lose? You see? Okay. So I said, so we have the first thing is like, in other words, what we said before, the first thing is philosophically know what the problem is. Now, fast day for the temple is because we lost the temple. Now the question is, what is the loss? Okay? The biggest loss, there are a few losses here. The biggest loss to the Jewish nation was its relationship, God's relationship to the nation. Okay? If you look, many times kids ask me that, you know, you read in the Torah about the miracles that we had, the prophecies, people that actually, that God spoke to. They said, boy, if we had that today, I would change overnight, you know? So the thing is, the question is, they said, how come we don't have it today? It's not there. They have it, but we don't. The answer is that they had it because there was God had a closer relationship to the Jews, you see? In other words, like this. There's two types of prophecies. There's a personal prophecy and a public prophecy. Personal prophecy is if you reach a certain level, then you see certain ideas that somehow it benefits you. Now that level of prophecy or that level of personal relationship that God has with you, that you will have once you reach a certain level. That's for any human being at any time. Even today, modern time. But however, the prophets that you read about in the Torah were the public prophets. And they only got their prophecy, their public prophecy, only insofar as God's relationship to the nation. You see? Okay? There's a difference, okay? Now, so if you look at the... So therefore, when you read through the Torah, when God had a personal relationship to us, so therefore we always had prophets and we had miracles. Okay? At the destruction of the temple of the Beis HaMikdash, then we lost the prophecy. Now sages say, what's the difference? He says that when we had the temple, then God's manifestation, God related to us through the temple. But after the destruction of the temple, God related us to us from heaven. You see? What does that mean? It means that there was a personal relationship. This is all metaphorical because God is not physical. But his relationship to us was a closer one when we had the temple. But it was further away when the temple was destroyed. So therefore, if you would recognize this when you see it that way, you see, then that's a terrible catastrophe. Another loss is, see, when you're raised in a society, you see, besides your parents having a large effect on you, the society also has an effect on you. Now, if you're raised in a society that is not based on the principles of Judaism, without realizing that these ideas seep in, and you have to start undoing it when you get older, when you have the knowledge. And if you don't undo it, then you'll make decisions based on it without realizing it. But if we had our own society, if we had a temple and we had our land, and it was and the land was guided by the laws of Torah, so then the society would be, you would be raised in a Torah society, how much easier, like it'll just, you just feel it, you sense it, and you'll be raised that way. That's the second type of loss. The third loss are all the laws that have to do with the temple and the concepts and the system, and you see the system operating. That's an, I mean, like, you see the perfection of the system. That's a third loss. You see? That is the loss. See, so therefore, sometimes when I just see the loss and I think about what I don't have today because of this, I have to start thinking, how can I get closer to God? I want to get that back. Even though I never experienced it, but it's possible to get it back. I have to start doing something. And if you say, I'm just one person, but that's what it takes, one person at a time. And maybe my doing it could affect others. You see? So the first purpose of a fast is nothing more than a reminder. It's like a reminder to remind you to investigate the importance of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash. You see? So now you start keeping the laws and you start studying Torah more. Now let's say, for instance, you reach a point where, or some area that you find is very, very difficult. Even with all this knowledge, you still can't make the move and do a certain act. Something is stopping you, an emotion. So then you would study, like we said, the emotion, and in general, the idea and concept of that emotion. What's its philosophy and what's its psychology and why is it stopping me? And analyze that. Okay, that would be the second stage. Again, a fast day is only a reminder to repent, and you fast, okay? And okay, so that's the second step. Now, the third step, the fast, I think, takes on a different connotation. You know, sometimes in the American society, a person has a food problem if they're overweight. But if you're not overweight, then we don't consider that you have a food problem, okay? But the thing is, we have a good test, okay, if you have a food problem. And that is try to fast for a 24-hour period without food or drink, okay? Now, suddenly, I mean, it's not impossible. I mean, you could do it and without problems. A person could live through it. But you'll notice that you start having really, like, you can't operate, you can't move, and many times there's no reason for it. So therefore, many times you'll notice that you have a psychological, something is psychological affecting you. The American society would say, that's crazy. I mean, that's no problem. That's an extreme. But we say, no, that it shouldn't affect you at all. Okay? Now, another way of recognizing this is when a person is through with the fast, how do they break the fast? You see? Rationally, if you go out on a full day fast, you shouldn't sit down to eat a big meal. Rationally, you should take some juice, drink water until your enzymes or your system starts working, and then you eat a little bit more later and slowly but surely. But most people, when they get off the fast, charge to the food, you see, which, oh yeah, so they, because there's a sense like a fear, terrible fears are awakened. Now sages realize that food is a very, very deep psychological thing, you see. Now, the thing is, for the person working on the third level where he's dealing with his personality, for him to be able to do, sometimes he could just start thinking, however it works, I mean, that he deals with his personality, but there's certain times there are things that are very deep and you can't get at, you see. Now, what happens is you have to sometimes put yourself in a situation to bring the emotions to the fore. So if a person operating on the third level, a fast forces him to realize these deep emotions that under normal conditions he wouldn't notice. And once it comes to the fore, then he could watch those emotions which are coming to recognize what they are, so then he knows what he has to deal with. You see? So therefore, fast day works on all three levels. I'm showing you. The first level is first know why you're fasting. fasting is because you lost something. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the loss? What did you lose? So you have to know what you lost. Then if you can't get to it, and you can't start changing, so then you have to analyze the emotion. If that doesn't work, then you have to undo the total personality. But the fast day, on the first two levels, is a reminder to think about it. Yeah, but on the third level, it actually helps you in your analysis to find out the deep emotions that are affecting your life. One is when analyzing emotions in general, is part of the analysis looking at the loss in your personal life, what you have if you live according to this emotion. And the answer is yes, in two ways, okay? The Book of Proverbs, its purpose, according to Sadyagon, is to show you the consequences of your actions that you do without thought by just following your emotions. Again, Sadyagon says that whenever a person lives not in line with reality, in other words, you're going against reality, then you must pay the consequences. And he says the Book of Proverbs is for the purpose of showing you the consequences of all areas of life that you make decisions not rationally but according to your emotions. So the thing is I think we've discussed this many times, the consequences of your actions. So definitely if you think about an emotional decision, just think about the type of consequences that you have gotten from them in your own life. That would be very important to see it in particular in your own life, how this emotion caused consequences, so you see the harm of it and why you should undo it. That's one problem. The second problem is that this is a very subtle point, and this is what Maimonides makes. He says that whenever you do an action, it affects your total being. Okay? Now, so every time you make a decision to do an irrational action, that strengthens your irrationality, and it makes it stronger and stronger. Like, for instance, I'll give you an illustration. Let's say, for instance, a person takes something from another person. Okay? A piece of paper, a pen, he uses his pen. Something of no big consequence. But when he does that act, there's one thing that he must have, a certain quality, and that is he doesn't respect another person or his property. Now, from that act, once he doesn't respect the person or that property, as he does more and more acts, he could do bigger and bigger damage to another person because he's training himself to respect other people even less to a point where he could actually kill a person, you see? So therefore, your emotions are not static. They're changing, you see? So the thing is, the damage that is done is that you're starting to make decisions besides the consequences. The consequences will be even worse because your very soul is changing. And also, there's one third loss, and that third loss, if you know the life of study, the life of Torah, and you see how it could give you a better life, and you're going in the opposite direction of the good life, that's a third loss. Because if you see that what you're losing, all the good life that you're losing, and the catastrophe that you're having here, in two ways, one, consequences of your actions, and two, are you affecting your very being that you could do worse actions? So if you start noticing these things, and if you look at the particulars, you know, like you see it in your everyday life and you see it happening, that definitely should help undo the emotion, whichever emotion you're dealing with. Like, there's a lot of small acts that you don't realize the ramifications of small acts adding up, and that it totally affects you in a totally way that it's unexpected.
What happens when you analyze so much that you get into what is called the paralysis of analysis, where you're trying so hard to make the right decision or the correct discernment in a situation that may be so vague or undefined that it's it seems impossible to do, and so you're afraid to make a mistake, and you just keep analyzing it to death.
To say that when Jacob left home, when he had his problem with Esau, and from that time till the time that he actually got to Laban, right, where he was dealing with, working for him, his uncle, they say there's a 14 years that are missing in the from the analyze. There's 14 years missing. And they say, what happened to that 14 years? So he says, they say that there was a school. There was a school at that time. It was run by a man by the name of Shem, who was one of the sons of Noach, and Aver, two people. Okay? 14 years studying. Okay? So the thing is that we say that a person, when they start out in life, a person has to start out where he should spend the first many years. I mean, Jacob was able to do for 14. Some people could do for 10. Some people could do for 20. Some people could only do for 5, whatever you could do, to spend most of your time in study, so that by the time you come out, you have a view and you have a method of thinking, and you have to know when you're killing it to death, you know, like you said, when you're going so far that you're just paralyzed, and when there's a certain point, you have to make a decision. There was a man by the name of Bachya ibn Pakuda. He wrote the book Duties of the Heart. And in his introduction, he says that he was thinking maybe he shouldn't write the book. Why? Because every time he went over the subject, he saw new insights. So he says he saw he was never finished. He says, but if he continues going this way, he'll never write the book. So at a certain point, you have to, in your analysis, you have to say, I analyzed it. It's time to make a decision based on the information that I analyzed. If I make a mistake, so then I'll have to correct it later. But paralyzed is also a mistake. Being paralyzed is itself a mistake. So you have to analyze that, the paralysis. You understand? That could also be an emotion, getting stuck and not being able to make a decision. You see? So the thing is that it takes a certain amount of time to study. Of course, if a person comes in to study when they already have a family and they're working, for them it's harder. There's no question. It's definitely harder, and they have to, in their spare time, to try to develop as much as they can. But if in their personal life they have to make a decision, they have to investigate to the best that they can, and knowing that paralysis is also a decision, the decision not to do anything. Now, you have to take the responsibility for that decision too. So paralysis is no answer. You must make a decision. With all the information, with all the training that I have, this is the decision what I can make now. If in 2 years you find out it's wrong, so then you'll retract and repent. Sadhguru says that a person should be secure with his mind and not be afraid to live according to his mind. He should have real security in what he thinks. Simultaneously, he should have enough humility to retract when he sees it's wrong. That's the formula that you must live by, and that way you will not be paralyzed by these type of thoughts. Is how to go about doing, in other words, to start thinking about it. Now, what was said here was, you know, you should just do it logically and clinically without any guilt. However, guilt is something that you cannot avoid. If you have it, you have it. But even how to deal with guilt has to be thought out too. In other words, like this. What happens is guilt sometimes forces you to do an act. But if guilt is forcing you to do an act, guilt itself is an emotion, and maybe that act based on guilt is wrong. What you have to do, if possible, and this takes a certain amount of thought, it is possible, but the thing is that you have to get that when you feel guilty about something, the guilt should say, now I have to think about, first of all, whether I should be guilty, whether I really am wrong. Maybe I wasn't wrong what I did. You see, the emotions, even the emotions of guilt or shame, shouldn't make a decision for you. But they should get you to, in other words, what guilt does do, it stops you from doing an act. Now, once it stops you from doing the act and you feel that guilt, now you have to say, should I live by my guilt or should I live by the act? Now, the guilt has given you one philosophy and the act has given you the opposite, right? Oh, so that's what we said when we first started this discussion, that you should analyze it philosophically, what's the right thing to do. Okay? Let's say, for instance, you hit somebody and you feel guilty about it. Well, sometimes we should hit people and it has to be analyzed whether this is a situation that the guilt is wrong and I should be hitting the person. Or maybe the guilt is right and I shouldn't be hitting the person. But that in itself has to be decided by the reason, by the mind. So we're not against guilt. But guilt is to get you to think, not to make a decision based on the guilt. Okay? The level of a person is where he feel, where his guilt is attached not to his infantile emotions, but through knowledge and study, his guilt becomes attached to ideas. And when he does something that is philosophically wrong, he feels guilty. That's the healthiest type of guilt you could have. They want me to repeat the idea. And that is this, that when guilt starts when we're a childhood, very young. That means the guilt is attached by when an infant, based on his infantile view of what is right and what is wrong. The way his parents trained him. But even if his parents trained him, he's still looking at his parents in an infantile manner. So all his decisions is made based on that infantile view, so the guilt is based on an infantile view. So therefore we say that therefore we shouldn't trust the guilt. But it is possible to develop in your thought, in your thinking, through the study of Torah, that it is possible where instead of the guilt attaching to the way it was trained in the infancy, you see, that very same guilt, you don't get rid of the guilt. What happens is the emotion attaches to your ideas of reality. So then when for some reason you don't live in line with reality, so then you feel guilty. That's a mature type of guilt. That's a healthy type of guilt. Person starts out with prayer. Basically, his idea of prayer is that I'll ask God for things. And if I'm a good person, then God will definitely give me my needs, right? The question is like this. Let's say, for instance, a child asks a parent for a bicycle, okay? And the parent doesn't feel the child should get the bicycle, and the parent says no. And the child constantly bothers, as children can do, and they... Every day they ask for a bicycle. Now, the parents at some point give in. Okay? They give in to the demands of the child and they buy the bicycle. Okay? Now, there was no change in the child. The child just kept asking the parents. Right? But there had to be a change in the attitude of the parent. Is that correct? There was a change in the attitude. There has to be some change. If there's no change in the child, then there must have been a change in the parent. If a person prays to God, and he asks God for things, and he just keeps saying over the prayers again and again, and keep asking God, if God would give him something, and there was no change in this person, then you must say there was a change in God, which by definition is an impossibility, because God is perfect. And therefore any change would mean that he wasn't perfect before and he's somehow bettered himself now, which is an impossibility because God is perfect and there can be no change in God. So therefore the nature of that prayer, if you pray basically only to ask God for things, then that's an incorrect view of God. Because what you're really demanding is since you don't have it, you're asking for God for there to be a change in God, and therefore he should give you whatever you want. Everybody accepts the premise, but the question is, then what is prayer? I mean, we read through the prayers, and we ask God for different things, and we expect that God will give it. Now, why is it in the prayer? If God doesn't give it, then why is it in the prayer? The answer is like this. The purpose of prayer is that it's supposed to make a change in you. Now, once there is a change in you, so then God can react to a different situation. There is no change in God. In other words, when God relates, sometimes he relates as a vengeful God. In other words, he demands justice, he does justice right now. Sometimes it's a merciful God. Doesn't mean that God has different qualities. It means that there are different situations that God relates differently to the different situations. Now, if you're on level A and you move to level B, then it's possible that at level B, since it's a new situation, God can grant what you wanted. If not yet, then you'll have to continue prayer to reach level C until you reach the point where there is a change that God could grant your wish. But the change must be in you and not in God. How does prayer change a person? In other words, if the purpose of prayer is to change you and you reach a higher level, so then how does it work? In other words, I have to know how prayer works. Right. A relationship to God, there are two steps in a relationship to God, okay? The first step is knowledge. Knowledge about God, whatever knowledge you have about God. Like the knowledge that we got this evening about God and about prayer and how prayer works. That's knowledge of God and how God relates to us and therefore how we should relate to God. So that is knowledge which brings us to a higher level. That brings us closer to God. That's one stage. But however, most of the times, even though our mind sees the idea, our emotions are not yet in line with it. So the review of the idea affects the emotion. Emotion needs constant review until it's affected. In other words, let's say, for instance, you would study prayer, and we would have a discussion, and we'd get the ideas, and we'd spend an hour working out one or two ideas. We get the ideas very clear. Our mind sees it. For the emotions to be affected, then all you have to do is just go over the results of that discussion. If the discussion is hazy, every once in a while maybe to go through the ideas again and discuss it out again. But for the emotions, the result of that discussion should affect the emotions. So therefore, by prayer, if you understand the ideas of prayer, and as you go over the ideas, then it's going to affect your emotions. Plus, as you study the ideas of Torah and the ideas of God, so then the prayer will also have different meaning to you as you develop on the mind level. The prayers will have a different meaning, and as it has a different meaning, then you must get your emotions in line with that meaning. In other words, your emotions, if you go out to pray now, basically you go back to however you related to God yesterday, basically you relate the same way emotionally, even though you realize that that's incorrect. So the way to change the emotions and get it in line with how your mind sees reality is by reviewing the ideas. That's one of the purposes of prayer. One of the purposes. It's not total, but it's one of the purposes of prayer.
Then the question is, if, say, praying for a sick relative is one small portion of a larger prayer, is simply going over that part of it, the praying for a sick relative, supposed to affect my emotions, or is it the review of all the various aspects which should include praise to God and so forth, and it's that affects my emotions?
The Shemona Esrei, 18 blessings that we stand the Shemona Esrei. So it starts with three blessings that deal with praise of God, and it ends with three blessings that deal with praise of God. All requests should be in always incorporated that praise should come first, you see, because that is the essence of prayer. The essence of prayer is your relationship with God. What's secondary is the request. See, most people start out, when you start out, and start relating to God, you cannot help but you relate to God via the request, and the request is the essence. But the truth is what's really the essence is the recognition of God and what He is. Now, as you recognize what He is, so then the request could take effect because there's a change in you. Plus, the request itself has a certain idea implied in it, that in every request, And that idea is that everything comes from God. Now, that idea itself is not, has to become part of our emotions. Many times the way we act as if, hey, I could do it myself, you see? Person has to know exactly what it means that everything comes from God. That in itself has to be analyzed and understood. Most people have a problem like this. It's either they're in total control or God is in total control. And usually which way they're going to turn usually depends on their situation. Okay? In other words, if I'm a poor person and I don't know where my next meal is going to come from, so I get down and I pray to God. Okay? I pray to God and I say, God, please help me. Okay? Now let's say God listens to the person's prayer and lo and behold, he becomes a millionaire. What does he usually say? Look how smart I was. He doesn't say, well, I thank God that he helped me. You see? It's usually these two extremes. Either you feel like you can't do anything and therefore you turn to God, or two, usually, I'm not saying in all cases, but in most cases, and usually when you're successful, you feel the, look, I did it. Okay? But the truth lies someplace in between here. Okay? Insofar as you making a decision, you must always make decisions in any given situation. Okay? For instance, Abraham, the Ralbag, a commentary on the Torah, says that Abraham had to make a decision by staying by famine, to die by famine, or to go down to Egypt, which he could be murdered. In fact, he had to tell his wife to lie, you know what I mean, say that that's my sister, because he knew his life was in danger. So he had to evaluate, but he didn't freeze. He stopped to think and say, look, either way I'm going to die, which is the better possibility that I could pull out of it? Person is obligated to do the best and the most that he can. Now, sages say that when Moses came down to the water, he started praying. God said, now is not the time to pray. And somebody else jumped up until his nose, and he says, God, one more step and I drown and the water split. Okay? What our sages are saying, a person must do every act that is possible to get himself out of any problem or to prepare himself for life. He must do the utmost with the clearest thought, with the best possible plan. Okay? Then when you're up to your nose and one more step and you drown, that is where you rely on God. In other words, insofar as results are concerned, that you rely on God. That's outside your jurisdiction results. Your job, it's a very hard thing, your job is to make correct decisions and realize that the results are, I mean, for instance, when you're crossing the street, you can look both ways and you're very careful. Here could be a drunk driver coming or driving on the sidewalk and kill you. That's out of your realm, you see. But you must still look both ways when you're crossing. You must do the best that you can. But whether you're actually going to make it across, that there are outside factors beyond your control, you see. When those outside factors, where there's nothing more that you can do, then you must pray, you see. In fact, Jacob, when he met Esau, Rashi says that he sent a peace offering to try and make a peace treaty, and then he divided the camp in two, it says. Rashi says that was preparing for war. And then the third thing he did was he prayed to God and asked them that one of those two plans should work, you see. So you see, he did everything possible that a human being can do, and then he relies on God. Now, the same thing when you come to request God of certain things, it should be in the same attitude where you've done everything that you can. You're not sitting back and saying, okay, God, please do whatever you can for me. I'm too tired today. You can't do that. You must do everything you can, and you must do every action that is necessary, but however, the results are in the hands of God. That's when prayer comes in. So when you request of God something, there is a recognition that results are not in my hands. you see? And if you really look around you, that fact is true. There's so many times you do something, there's dozens of outside factors that could affect the results. So therefore, you must do whatever you as a human being can do, and then you pray to God for the result, and that your activities, whatever you did, can help. You see? So therefore, there's a recognition of precisely and exactly how God helps you and what you're obligated to do to get the results and then to rely on God for them. Okay? And then the request, when you're requesting, there's also a certain idea that you are dependent on God for those results. And you must review that very idea. Because most of the times, emotionally, when we get results, we usually feel very good about it and say, look at all my work, what I did, and I really accomplished something. Right? The truth is, no, you just did the correct action. But there's too many factors that are not in your hands. That it came about is not in your hands. You see? Results. When results come about, let's say it's bad results, a person, that's a separate question, really, but the person should investigate what caused this bad effect. If I made a mistake, then I have to see what the mistake was and undo that type of mistake, so it shouldn't make it again. If I didn't make any mistake, but I see it was totally an outside factor, then I have to accept God's will. That's it. We know if we did everything that we, everything that's possible that we did we do everything possible? The answer is as you develop in thought, then you will see where you made mistakes prior. In other words, right now you're doing everything what you think is best and what you thought out. But as you develop through the study of Torah and your mind develops, you'll start seeing where you made certain mistakes. You'll check it over and correct those mistakes so now you could really do that which is best. It's a constant development that you constantly, in other words, it's two things. One, you're developing in the practical to work out the practical to the best that you can. Because that's part of your responsibility. You can't just rely on God. And two is you're working out your relationship with God. These two things bring about that God can help you. But if he doesn't, then you must accept God's will. This is God's will.
Is that a lot of people in perhaps religious circles pray a lot and make lots of requests and then seem to get answers to their requests and say that, gee, God answered this prayer, God answered that prayer. Is there any validity to that?
I don't know if I could answer the validity of a prayer coming when God answers a prayer where he doesn't. I mean, I don't know if I could answer that. But I just want to say that an attitude, that if I pray to God that God will answer me, there is a situation where he will break down. There is a book in one of the books of the Torah called Job. Okay? And Job was a righteous man. If you read the introduction, what it says about him, he was complete, like perfect, like the same praise we say about Jacob. He says he was straight, clear and straight, like just. He feared God, he feared God or feared sin, and he turned away from evil. These are the four things that the Torah, when they start the book of Job, they say these four things about Job, and then a terrible catastrophe happens. He loses his family, he loses his wealth, and he gets very, very sick. Okay, like a disease, a painful skin disease. And he starts questioning God, and the whole book is his questions about God and how he comes to answers. But the thing is, one thing they did not say about Job, that he was wise. Why? Because he was lacking the knowledge of the relationship between a human and God. If your relationship to God is basically what I could get out of God, there will be a time. I mean, you'd have to be really, really lucky that everything works out exactly that fits your emotions perfectly. But usually there will be a time where there's going to be a situation and you're not going to be answered, and suddenly you're going to turn against God. You see? That's the book of Job. Now, we had a Rebbe Akiva that was tortured to death, And he was happy. In fact, the students asked him, how come you're so happy? You see? The difference between Job and Rabbi Akiva is the difference between knowledge and lack of knowledge. One person has an incorrect relationship to God, and sometime reality will prove that that relationship is wrong, and he'll break down. But if through knowledge he changes and sees the true relationship to God, then that person will not break down even under torture. Okay? Now, the difference in the relationship is one person relates to God like a demand. You know what I mean? Like, I'll pray to you, and you give me things. If a catastrophe happens and the person doesn't get what he wants, then he gets angry with God. You didn't keep your part of the deal. But however, the true relationship to God is that I pray to God, like we said before, and I recognize that results are in the hand of God, but yet I accept God's decree, whatever God's will is. When King David was running from his son, Absalom, and he was leaving the city, he said, I'll be back if it's God's will. But if it's God's will that I will not be king anymore, then we must accept God's will. Then we'll just have to accept that. You see? According to his understanding, he says, I should be back. God is just punishing me. And once he gets through with the punishment and I do repentance, then at a certain point I should be back. But if I'm making a mistake in my evaluation, if for some reason God is saying that, no, I'm not going to bring you back, and that's it, you're going to suffer the rest of your life, then King David says, then we must accept God's will. You see? That difference, to be able to accept God's will, is not just a verbal thing, where Burns says, oh, we have to accept God's will. It's not a verbal thing. It's a level of knowledge as you recognize the truth and reality of the world, that this is the way God runs the world. If you think God runs the world that if you request of him and he's going to give something to you, it's not necessarily true. That's why Rabbi Akiva, he didn't deserve the punishment, but he doesn't know why. He accepts God's will. This is God's will, then I accept God's will. For whatever reason, even if I don't understand it. But that is not an emotional commitment. It's based on knowledge, and then your emotions are in line with that knowledge. Then you can reach that level of Rabbi Akiva. But if you do not have that knowledge, then you will break down like Job. The whole book of Job is the search for that knowledge and how to relate to God. You see? At the end, Job does find the basis, the beginning of the correct relationship to God. And basically, it's accepting reality for what it is. Whatever happens in the physical world, it must be God's will. God created the world. He made the laws of nature. If he wants, he can intervene. So he did, right? This is all God's will. So whatever happens is God's will. Now, the only way I could change it is God tells us the formula. Like we said, that the recognition of God, and then try to get my emotions in line. But there is no guarantee. Just because it's a better chance, that's the only way that God could relate to you. But the fact that you do it, you see in the case of Rabbi Akiva, there are other factors. If you look at the story of Eliyahu Hanavi, Eliyahu the prophet. Now, when he went into Israel and got on the mountain opposite the idol worshippers, and God brought down fire and burnt the offering, he was not worried. He was totally protected by God because he was on God's mission. But right after that, Jezebel, right, that was Ahab, Ahab's wife, makes a contract on Elijah's life. And Elijah runs away. Why? Because the thing is, his mission is over, and now he has to live according to the laws of nature and do the best that he can and run. If he doesn't run, there's no guarantee God is going to perform a miracle for him. Right when he's on the mission, he walks right in there, not afraid of the whole country, on his own. He relies on God, that God will help him. Why? Because God says, go on a mission. So he's on a mission of God. As soon as the mission is over, then he has to do what reality demands. The best thing, I better get out of here because they have a contract out on me. So he runs. He does the best that he can, and then the hopes that God will help him with the results. Mm-hmm. So you see, even the prophets operate this way. This is the formula. Okay? If you want to get close to God, okay, it's only via the knowledge and prayer. Those are the two things that get you close to God. Okay? And those are the things that will bring, if God wants to, will give you success. But however, there is no guarantee. And then when it doesn't come, then you must have enough knowledge and acceptance of God via the knowledge that I've learned to accept reality for whatever it is. And then it doesn't make any difference to me. I accept it. That's it. And I still accept God. That is the difference between Job at the beginning of the book and Rabbi Akiva.
The question is, if things don't go well or if bad things happen to a person, should the person automatically assume that God is punishing them, or is that just an emotional myth?
When bad happens, there's no guarantee that it comes from God. It might be simply you're under the laws of nature. That's why Elijah started to run when a contract was out on his life. He felt that maybe he's just under the laws of nature. Maybe God would not protect him. His mission is over, so therefore he's on the run. Okay? But when something does bad happen within the laws of nature, you should do two things. Okay? One, check over what you practically could do to the best possible act that you could do in this situation. That's the first thing you should do. And then two, get closer to God either via knowledge of God or via prayer and going over the ideas and getting your emotions in line, so that as you change and reach closer to God, then after all your actions, then it's possible for God to help you. That's the formula. Something goes wrong, okay? We cannot tell. It's possible and probable that it's the laws of nature. But it is possible that you did something wrong. But the fact is, you do not know why. If it's God doing it, then unless a prophet comes and says, God is doing this, and for this reason, you do not know. So therefore, the formula is simply a general formula. That first, you should work out practically what you can do in this situation. And two, you should pray to God and try and get closer to God so that God could bring about the result from everything that you have done. Unless practically you're in a situation where there's nothing you can do, like Rabbi Akiva, he was captured. So the only thing he could do is to relate to God. That's it. There's nothing else. Okay? In the book of Leviticus, in the portion of Shemini, in chapter 10, verse 1, it says that the two children of Aaron brought a strange or foreign fire that was not commanded them. In other words, it was not commanded by God. What does it mean, it was not commanded by God? What does that mean? What it means by not command them, it means it was not according to halacha. Halacha is the Hebrew word for Jewish law, okay? So therefore, it was not according to halacha. They did not get it as a law from Mount Sinai, from God, but somehow in their desire to serve God, they somehow went over the bounds and they gave a foreign fire. Foreign fire, what it means is that it was not according to halacha, or Jewish law. The Haftorah is concerned, a little background before we get to the story of the Haftorah. The story is that in a battle prior, someplace in the book of Judges, no, in the beginning in Shmuel Aleph, I'm sorry, the beginning of Samuel 1, we lost the ark in the war, okay? And that ark, through a miraculous miracle, it came back to Israel, and it came over the border, and the people were farmers when they saw it, so they came to the ark and they touched it, or they looked at it, They wanted to see him. Many of them died, and so they just left the ark in that place. I guess they covered it. But it was there for many, many years, until King David came and decided to bring the ark to Jerusalem. Okay? Our Haftorah is, this week's portion, is where King David is bringing the ark back from this city to Jerusalem. Okay? Verse 6, it's in Samuel 2, chapter 6, and we're going to do verse 6. It says, they came to the threshing floor of Nachon, and Uzzah reached out to the ark of God and grasped it, for the oxen had shifted it. The anger of Hashem flared up against Uzzah, and God struck him there for the error. Uzzah died there by the ark of God. The question is that the ark was going to fall and Uzzah was going to protect it. Why did he die? He was going to stop it from falling. Why did he die? The reason is because we're commanded not to touch the ark. And again, he did it not according to halacha. Okay? That's why this Haftorah was placed here with this portion, this weekly portion. What I would like to explain is two ideas. The idea of halacha, of law, and then the error that these people made and how it came about. The question is, was there ever in the history of the human race that the human race ever did not have any halacha? The creation of Adam, was there a time that we did not have halacha? Of course, the first halacha that we had was don't eat of the tree. That was the first law that Adam got. That was halacha. Okay? After that, there's a difference of opinion among the sages what the halacha was, what the law was, from after we were sent out of the Garden of Eden until Noah, you see. There's a difference of opinion what halacha they had at that time. But the fact is there was no time in history that we did not have halacha. Halacha is always given to man. Okay? There is a difference of opinion what it was, but there was no difference of opinion that halacha did exist from Adam till Noah. Okay. Now the first commandment that the Jews were given, and it was given in Egypt. Halacha that the Jews were given in Egypt, and the first halacha as a nation that they received was the law of the new moon. The question is, why is this so important? I mean, I could understand if the next law is Passover. Now, I could understand Passover. That has to do with the whole Exodus, with the whole idea of freedom, and God is now relating to us as a nation. Why is it so important that the first law should be the law of the new month? Well, we have to ask, which person would you ask when a month begins or ends? What type of a person would you ask? Normally, to decide on when months begin or end, we would certainly ask an astronomer. He is the one that could tell us when the moon has changed and all the different things. Now the truth is, in law we do rely on astronomy in deciding the month. We do rely on astronomy, and it really is only a difference of 2 days, because we have a 29 day month or a 30 day month. That is according to the lunar calendar. Now what they had was, the court never convened at night except on the 28th at night, or just before the 29th, they would convene, and if it was a clear night, two witnesses would come to the court, and with charts they would give testimony on where the moon was and the form and all these things. They would ask different questions, and based on these two people, who were plain ordinary people that just happened to have seen the moon, the court, the Besdin, would make a decision when the new month begins. Okay? What is that telling us? That who makes decisions about the world? It's God. It's halacha. It's God that makes the decisions. It's true we have to ask. It's true we have to ask the scientists to get the information. But the decision on how we're going to live is based on halacha. Now, halacha can never be proven from any place in the physical world. No human being could prove halacha. There's no way. There's nothing in the physical world that would dictate any of these ideas. Not the system. So therefore, the only way to get halacha is from Mount Sinai, what God gave to Moses. And that is that is what we must obey. That is our relationship to God. Again, on the holiday of Yom Kippur, when we're not permitted to eat. And if somebody is sick, the rabbi will discuss the problem with a doctor, but who will make the decision? Again, it'll be the rabbi that'll make the decision. You see? And when you make money, many people give charity. Now, some people, there are usually two emotions associated with charity. One is that, look, I'm such a good person, I'm giving up my money. The other is, I feel so bad, I'm giving away my money, I could be doing something with it. You see? But the truth is both these emotions are false. Because God told you, there's a certain amount of money that's not yours. The rest you have to use. But it's God who dictates how you should live. Which money is yours. You might go to work, but God dictates which money is yours and which is not. And if he says there's a certain amount that's not yours, certain taxes or whatever it is, then or certain charities, so then that's it. It's not yours. God said it's not yours. Simple thing. You can't take pride in it, and you can't feel bad that you're giving away your money. It's God who tells you what's yours. Remember when we came to Jericho, the first city that we were to capture in Israel, the Israelites were to capture. If you remember, they were supposed to go around the city once a day. That was one law. They were supposed to be quiet. That was another. The blowing of the shofar. And then the seventh day, seven times around again. The first time we capture a city, God is telling us, you will have your country. And God will perform miracles to help you keep that country, provided you keep halacha. It's all based on halacha. So you must keep halacha. Okay? There is nothing else you could do for your relationship to God. Okay? Except keep halacha. Okay? And that is obeying God. That is what we mean that you obey God. You obey God by doing exactly what he says. Knowledge of God is another subject. Which we're not going to discuss the study of God. We've discussed it many times. But right now we're just discussing the aspect of halacha. Just the aspect of halacha. Of course you have to know why you're doing it, right? Why are you doing halacha? Because there's a God. Well, who is God? God is only a word. Who is God? So you have to know who God is. You see what I mean? But the thing is that the knowledge of God is not the subject that we're dealing with. This fits into it. It'll be connected, but we're just talking about the actions which God commands us insofar as halacha. And insofar as halacha is concerned, there was never a human being that did not have a command of some type of halacha from the time that Adam was created. What I'm trying to say is halacha is obeying God. Getting close to God, yes, getting close to God would take the knowledge of God. Is getting close to God. But however, there's obeying God. Okay? And obeying God would also bring you close to God, but it's a result of your knowledge of God. Okay? Obeying God is a result of your knowledge of God. So, of course, getting close to God is simply knowledge of God. And understanding how he relates to us, the ideas how he relates to us, and how we relate to him. But there is a part in our relationship to God of obeying God, and that is halacha. We must always show that we accept and recognize God by obeying halacha.